Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Wetico. I'm James Atkinson, Senior Brand Manager at DK Eyewitness.
And I'm Lucy Richards, Senior Editor at DK Eyewitness.
And welcome to Wetico, where every fortnight we find out more about the world's favourite travel destinations with those people who know those places best. And today we have one of those people who knows the world kind of best, really. So it's a sort of special episode because we are joined by our friend Shafiq. So Shafiq, you may remember, spoke to us about Unforgettable Journeys in season one, all that time ago. But Shafiq is a true veteran of a lot of the publishing that we do at DK Eyewitness. He's a real expert. Our team rely on him for his kind of knowledge around the world. And very excitingly, he's got a new book out. So we need to talk about that, basically.
We do. He's also just an all-round lovely chap. So it'll be lovely to be chatting to him about various destinations today.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited to find out where he's actually planning to go to, because knowing Shafiq, I mean, he's kind of been everywhere, I think.
He has, and he has been to some, I think he favours some particularly, you know, amazing, wild, epic destinations. So yeah. I think we're in for a real odyssey today.
The real extremes kind of offered up by the world. So without further ado, yeah, let's go speak to Shafiq.
Yes, Shafiq is an award-winning journalist, travel writer, author, editor, broadcaster and photographer who has co-authored more than 50 guidebooks for Rough Guides, Lonely Planet, Time Out, many others, including, of course, us at DK Eyewitness. And his new book, Crossed Off the Map, Travels in Bolivia, was published on the 15th of March this year.
So huge congratulations to Shafiq on the publication of his book, and welcome Shafiq. Hello.
Welcome.
Thanks, guys. Lovely to be speaking to you again.
Welcome to the podcast. Welcome back, I should say.
Yay.
Yes. Yeah, we're very excited to talk to you about a range of destinations. So as we normally kick things off, we'll be finding out a little bit more about Shafiq, and then we'll have three sections, one on each destination he loves, starting off, of course, with the subject of his new book, Bolivia.
So, Shaf, you've travelled so much as a travel writer. This is a hard question, but what do you sort of love most about the job, you know, apart from the obvious, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, on a very basic level, I find it an incredibly rewarding, challenging, invigorating experience. Working as a travel writer constantly throws me into contact with new people, places, ideas and experiences, while indulging my curiosity and restlessness. It also provides me with, you know, a greater sense of freedom than I think I would have in almost any other career, though not without its challenges, and certainly not always as glamorous as people might think. Working as a travel writer is a huge privilege.
Yeah, so it's not just going on holidays, is it? It's very much kind of strategically thinking about what you're doing, where you're going, how you're writing about it, how you're responding to briefs, etc., and working for, you know, it's hard work, basically, isn't it?
Absolutely. I'm glad we finally got some recognition of the hard
work
that goes into travel writing.
Absolutely. And you're going to talk to, I mean, it must have been quite hard because you've been to many, many, many places and you're going to talk to us about just three of them today. How did you kind of settle upon those three without giving too much away about each?
Well, I mean, it was a difficult challenge just narrowing it down to three destinations. Because as you say, I've been lucky enough to kind of work all around the world as a travel writer. I think it really goes back to my childhood. I've always been an inveterate reader, and childhood books about places like the Amazon, Patagonia, the Himalayas, the vast expanse of Antarctica captured my imagination and never really let go. With India, one of the countries I'm going to talk about, there was a family connection too. My paternal family are originally from Gujarat, but moved to Uganda and then to the UK and beyond. Visiting Antarctica was always a dream. I think it probably originated from watching, you know, countless David Attenborough wildlife documentaries while I was growing up. And Bolivia, in many ways, encapsulates everything I love about travel. You know, incredible landscapes, culturally rich, and a fascinating history as well.
Let's start with Bolivia. So I want to know kind of when did you first visit Bolivia? I mean, you've traveled pretty extensively across South America. Was Bolivia the first place you visited?
Well, I mean, it goes back to my very first visit to South America back in 2004. This was before I was a travel writer. I was a sports reporter in London at the time. But with my girlfriend at the time, you know, we decided to leave our jobs and go backpacking around India and then around South America for the best part of a year. And after having Carnival in Rio, we headed over to Peru to hike the Inca Trail, to Machu Picchu, you know, classic gringo trail activities. But the overland journey between the two took us through Bolivia, which I really didn't know much about at the time. But after, you know, exploring from the Andes to the Amazon, I really became fascinated by the place. Scroll forward a few years, and I was living across the border in Argentina. And at that time, I became the co-author of The Rough Guide to Bolivia. And that allowed me to travel around the country in far greater depth than would otherwise have been possible. And it was through these travels that the idea for my new book, Crossed Off the Map, really came to light.
Cool.
So tell us a bit more about the book then, Shaf. What sort of, you know, what can readers expect from the book?
Yeah, I mean, over the last 15 years, I've worked as a travel writer on all seven continents, but I've never visited anywhere quite like Bolivia. You know, I think like lots of travellers, I was initially drawn in by its dramatic landscape. You know, it has the world's biggest salt flat, the world's highest city, the world's most biodiverse national park, to name just a few. It's also remarkably culturally rich. But as I got to know Bolivia better, I began to learn about its profound, unexpected impacts on the world. Fragments of history that have largely been forgotten beyond its borders. I also realised that it stood on the front line of many of the touchstone issues of the 21st century, from the climate emergency to populism. You know, it was just too good a story not to tell. So Bolivia, despite being roughly twice the size of France, shares borders with Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Peru, Paraguay, is right in the heart of South America. But it tends to be overshadowed by its neighbours. You know, it never really makes much of an appearance in the international media. Travel writers all seem to hurry through it en route to somewhere else. You know, there hasn't been a major travelogue about it, about Bolivia for many years. So I saw a gap in the market for a book that, you know, explored its fascinating history, you know, its incredible landscapes, and also looked at how Bolivia is coping with all these contemporary challenges and what it can tell all of us around the world about what we can expect in the future.
And kind of, is that what you meant by like sort of the title Crossed Off the Map, in terms of, you know, it's generally not really seen as part of that kind of the what you kind of described as the gringo trail earlier, like as people's main routes around Latin America as somewhere that it is a destination in and of its own right as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, so the title Crossed Off the Map comes from an apocryphal story from the 19th century about a supposed diplomatic spat between Queen Victoria and and Bolivia, which resulted in the expulsion of the ambassador. Anyway, supposedly after this, according to the story, which is known as the Black Legend, in South America, Queen Victoria took a map of Bolivia, took a map of South America and ceremoniously crossed Bolivia's name off of it. Now, you know, that's an apocryphal story. It's probably a tall tale, but, you know, it seemed to really sum up in many ways, you know, what's actually happened to Bolivia over the, you know, the subsequent 150 years or so. Sometimes really feels as if Bolivia was crossed off the map.
Fascinating.
Yeah. I was going to say, so for those kind of, I don't know, to kind of sum up Bolivia for people who would want to kind of visit there or something, what are some of the main things that you would kind of have to see? I mean, I'm not asking you to tell your whole book or spoil your whole book within the answer to one question, but kind of, you know, what are some of the things that we're actually missing out on?
I mean, I really could talk about this all day, but I'm not gonna put you through that. I'll keep it short.
Other destinations to get through, remember, and one's India. It's pretty massive.
Absolutely. Well, I mean one of the things I love about Bolivia really is its sheer geographical diversity. You got mountains and rainforests, salt flats and wetlands. Mm-hmm. So I will say to people, you know, I absolutely love the western Andean side of the country, particularly the Salar de Uyuni and the neighbouring reserva Eduardo Avaroa. So these are otherworldly landscapes. A gleaming salt flat, roughly the size of Jamaica, islands of giant cacti and these creatures called vishkashas, which are like rabbits. You have smouldering volcanoes and lakes that have been stained red and green by minerals. Huge flocks of flamingos. So I love that part of it. And that's often the side of Bolivia that most people associate with the country. But also a third of the country is within the Amazon basin. And I absolutely love this region, particularly Parque Nacional Medidi. So you can only access it by boat from a former rubber trading town called Ruanabaque. And it's roughly the size of Wales. And it's also the most biodiverse protected area on Earth. To put that in context, it's home to roughly 1,000 species of birds, which is almost 10% of the world's total in this park alone.
Wow,
seriously.
And it's also home to an array of jaguars and anacondas, stingrays, spectacled bears, and these incredible creatures called bufeos, which are pink river dolphins. You know, if you visit today, you may be lucky enough to get the chance to swim with them. They're incredibly playful, intelligent animals, and that's one of my most memorable experiences in travel is swimming with these dolphins in the Amazon.
Oh well, I'm not surprised. That sounds amazing. Did you say that 10% of the world's bird population is in that particular region?
So roughly 10% of the bird species on Earth can be found in this park alone, and this is only a small part of the Bolivian Amazon as a whole. And it's got, you know,
that's amazing.
That's in the space size of Wales.
Roughly the size of Wales. You know, you always have to compare things to Wales to kind of give a gravitas to the size.
Wales is that kind of unfortunate, like, geographical stencil that we put on a lot of things.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's an amazing natural landscape. Are there sort of towns and cities in Bolivia, or is it significantly, are you going for sort of wildlife?
Yeah, I mean, an awful lot of people are drawn both by the wildlife and by the natural attractions. You know, on the Andean side, I haven't even mentioned Lake Titicaca, the world's highest.
Of course,
One of the world's highest lakes. And you know, you've got huge plains. You've got the Pantanal, which Bolivia shares with Brazil, which is the world's largest tropical wetlands, is equally rich in wildlife there. But the cities are absolutely fascinating too. I mean, a lot of Bolivia is a very high altitude place. You've got two of the highest cities on Earth in El Alto and Potosi. They're also in incredibly dramatic Andean locations. And they're very culturally rich. You know, El Alto, which neighbours the de facto capital, La Paz. It's one of the fastest growing cities in Latin America. It's got an incredibly strong indigenous culture. It's kind of wonderful markets. It's a very vibrant, fascinating place. And then not too far away is Potosi, which has, you know, a fascinating and tragic history. So the richest silver mine ever discovered is in a mountain that overlooks the city. According to legend, so much silver was taken out of this mountain during the Spanish colonial era, you could have built a solid silver railway line all the way from Bolivia to Madrid. You know, it's had a profound impact on everything from the Industrial Revolution to the Great Wall of China. You know, and it's also in Potosi today, it kind of has resulted in these incredible architectural riches, churches and mansions, the Royal Mint. So, you know, those are just two of the cities that are kind of fascinating to visit. And you also have somewhere called Sucre, which is, in my opinion, one of the most beautiful places in Latin America. It's the historic centre of it is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's nicknamed the White City because everything is whitewashed. And, you know, it feels like walking around a film set.
Cool. I think I have heard of that, about that. Yeah. It's what kind of like... What gave it its, you know, is it like really, really old? What gave it its kind of heritage site status?
So the thing with Sucre is linked to the silver mines in Potosi, because Potosi is a high altitude place. It's quite inhospitable to live in. Sucre is, you know, more than 1,000 meters lower, has a much more temperate climate, and so lots of the wealthy mine owners would move to Sucre subsequently, and they, you know,
so the wealth kind of trickle down really, and
yeah, absolutely, and kind of later, you know, it's home to one of the oldest universities in South America. For a long period, it was Bolivia's capital. It's still the de jure capital, even though most of the political action has moved to La Paz. So it's got a lot of heritage, a lot of culture, and it's also a very cosmopolitan place. It's attracted kind of people from all around the world, which kind of gives it a really nice vibe. It's also home to the most fascinating cement works, I think, on the planet.
Okay.
This sounds pretty strange, and it's on the outskirts of the city. And when you first look at it, it just looks like a quarry, essentially, with a huge white dusty cliff with tractors going past and smoke bellowing out of the of the chimneys. But if you look closely at the cliff face, you'll notice there's all these patterns on it, and it's actually the world's biggest collection of dinosaur footprints. So paleontologists think that there was a stampede. So essentially, lots and lots of, you know, thousands of dinosaurs chasing across this vast plain, which then through tectonic pressure was pushed up when the Andes was formed, and has now been exposed in this quarry. So it's got a lot of kind of really diverse, interesting things to see and experience.
Okay, that's a great quarry.
I don't think that we've had dinosaurs mentioned on the podcast before, James.
I think that might be a podcast first. Yeah, yeah. No. Jurassic Coast. We've talked about the Jurassic Coast.
Oh yeah. But a stampede of dinosaurs, that's really, really cool, Chef.
Yeah,
that's good fact.
It's definitely our first stampede of dinosaurs, for sure.
Glad to hear it.
I was going to finally kind of ask about Bolivia, because, I mean, I think one of the things that's synonymous with it, for better or worse, is altitude. And I know, like, tapping into your inner, your old sports writer self, Chef, like, am I right in thinking La Paz has like the highest football pitch or international football pitch in the world or something? Or that might be Quito in Ecuador, I'm not too sure.
Yeah, Bolivia, so La Paz has a very high altitude international football stadium. I think it's around 3,600 metres above sea level. Yeah. And as you might expect, Bolivia, that in general terms doesn't have a great record in international football, as anyone who follows the South American football closely, but they have a formidable home record.
That's what I was thinking of, because teams find it quite difficult to go there.
And actually, funny enough, I mean, when the time before last that I was there, Bolivia beat Argentina at home.
So there was
a sign of lots of rejoicing. An even higher football stadium, though, is in El Alto, which is the neighbouring city, just a bit higher. And they've got a team that has been nicknamed the PSG of Bolivia because they've had a lot of money pumped into them recently.
Yes.
And their, their home ground is above 4,000 meters of altitude. And they're doing really well in the South American equivalent of the European Cup at the moment. So, one to watch out for.
Yeah, I think I've just heard so many stories of players feeling sick or passing out halfway through games and stuff.
Oh, Lord.
But I was going to ask, that was my tenuous link to drive it towards football. But actually, I really wanted to ask kind of how you deal with the altitude when you're there. Like, have you got used to it when you visited, or does it take a while?
Yeah, it always hits you, and you always feel it, even if you don't actually suffer from altitude sickness itself. I mean, The highest international airport is in El Alto, and an awful lot of people will fly there from sea level, and it does hit you hard. I mean, I always advise take it very, very easy for the first couple of days. In La Paz, locals have a saying about how to cope with the altitude, which is to drink little, eat little, and sleep alone. So kind of take it very, very easy. But it can have a serious impact. So you want to be aware of it. And it's unpredictable. You can be very fit, physically fit and, mm-hmm. Young and all of that. And it can still hit you. They often advise, drinking coca leaf tea or chewing coca leaves, which are legal in Bolivia. Not legal outside of Bolivia. Do not take them out, away with you. But inside, that can help to alleviate some of the symptoms of the altitude. Typically the best treatment for altitude sickness is to descend, of course. It definitely hits you. And, just walking around the streets, I always think it gives you an insight into the aging process, because climbing a small flight of stairs, feels like scaling Everest.
Yeah.
It really takes it out of you.
Fascinating.
Well, thanks so much for that intro to Bolivia, Shafiq. And I think obviously listeners can hear a lot more about Bolivia in your book, Crossed Off the Map. But we are now going to quickly discuss India.
So obviously talking about India, which is huge, Shaf, so I doubt we're going to cover everywhere. Are there any sort of specific regions that you want to particularly highlight?
Yeah, I mean, I always like to champion Madhya Pradesh, which is a state in central India. That I think is really underappreciated by foreign tourists. It's home to some fantastic tiger reserves, particularly Karna and Bandhavgarh. In these places, you have as good a chance of spotting these big cats in the wild as anywhere on Earth. To give you a little flavour of that, the last time I visited Karna, before the pandemic, I was in a taxi outside the park, just driving along the road, and a tiger crossed the road in front of us, bringing us to a halt. Very confidently spent a few minutes, trotting over. So, I mean, just to put, it shows just how easy it is to see these big cats in the wild. To see a tiger in the wild is a mesmerizing experience. But elsewhere in Madhya Pradesh is very varied. There's a wonderful UNESCO World Heritage site called Khajuraho. And this is a kind of a stunning collection of temples that are covered by, eye-opening and incredibly inventive erotic carvings. There's various theories about these sculptures.
This might be a first, erotic carvings.
This is definitely a first, yes.
Dinosaurs and erotic carvings. I try and bring a bit of difference to the point. So there's lots of theories
Erotic carvings, let's go back.
Yeah. So there's lots of theories about why these temples are covered by these, frankly, eye-opening sculptures. Some people say they represent Shiva's wedding party. Others say they were linked to a tantric cult. Some people even say they were inspired by the Kama Sutra.
That's what I was going to suggest.
Yeah. So whatever the reason, they're a remarkable thing to see. Less erotically charged, but similarly impressive. Madhya Pradesh is also home to one of the oldest religious structures in South Asia. It's a Buddhist stupa, which is like an iconic dome temple, and it's called Sanchi, and it dates back to the 3rd century BCE. It sits alone in the countryside and is a tranquil, remarkable place to have a look around.
Amazing. That's a really, really, really good quick guide to
a good varied travel guide within that.
Super succinct, super helpful. And you mentioned about kind of like, you know, when you talked about kind of travel writing for the first time, like how you left and went to India was your first destination, right? When you went there, what's kind of brought you back like time and time again?
I mean, I think it's, you know, the sheer size and diversity of India in all senses of the world means you could spend a lifetime exploring it and still only scratch the surface. You know, there's some truth in the old cliche that it's more like a continent than a country. Yeah. And every time I go, I just discover more places that I need to visit the next time. And the other thing is the food, of course, which is sensational and much more varied than the Indian food we typically get in the UK. At the moment, I particularly love the cuisine of Calcutta, mm-hmm. as was, you know, which has excellent seafood, often flavoured with coconut and mustard oil. There's a strong tradition of Indian Chinese cuisine there. The street food is great. They've got something called a catty roll, which is like a paratha flatbread stuffed with goodies and kind of spiked with chili and lime juice. And plenty of sweets as well. And they have a very sweet tooth in the city. So, it's fantastic to give you an insight into the culture in India. Or in fact, the very myriad cultures in India.
Would you say kind of like that first visit to India like kind of sparked your, you know, did you know you wanted to become a travel writer at that point? Or was it still like kind of early days really?
Yeah, when I set off traveling, as I say, I was a sports reporter. I was covering football and cricket mainly for the Evening Standard in London, which was something that I'd always wanted to do up to that point. But it was this trip and my time in India and then in South America that really the idea of becoming a travel writer kind of came to mind. I did my first bits of travel writing while I was over in the countries, you know, and I use the guidebooks and kind of thought, I wonder who writes these books. That would be a great job. it was, you know, without sounding overly dramatic, it was a life-changing trip because I left on my travels as a sports reporter and I came back wanting to become a travel writer. And then, you know, there were a few ups and downs before I managed to make it happen. But yeah, that was the impetus behind it.
Be honest, you were really reading those guidebooks and thinking like, who writes these? I can do better. I know I can like get better stuff in there, right?
I definitely thought this will be quite. This just looks an easy, glamorous job. All the cliches that people have with travel writing, you know, who don't work in the industry, I had all of them beforehand. And you know, one of my great disappointments in life in that it hasn't been as easy and as glamorous all the time as I perhaps hoped.
As people think.
Yeah. Yes. Yep. I mean, we know many, many guidebook writers, and it's certainly not as glamorous as you'd think.
So, Chef, the only place I've done in India has been the Golden Triangle. So that's Delhi, Agra, and Jaipur. So that's a massively popular sort of portion of the country. Are there any kind of hidden gems away from, you know, those cliched trips that, you know, you're willing to share with readers?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of places spring immediately to mind. You know, as long as you guys and the listeners promise to keep them to yourselves, okay?
Yeah,
yep. So, don't worry, you can trust us.
Good, excellent, excellent. Yep. I'm glad I got your word
for
it.
Very trustworthy. That's, and I'm sure our listeners are too.
Yeah. Well, so the first is in Madhya Pradesh again, and it's called Orcha, which is a town. The name Orcha literally translates as hidden place, and it's a medieval complex of forts and temples, palaces, tombs and gardens along the banks of the Betwa River, kind of lapped up by the ever-encroaching forest. You know, it's a tranquil and atmospheric place to while away a few days. You can literally stay in a palace there if you want. Cool. It's Orchard's not exactly unknown. It's just down the road from Cajarel, but it really receives far fewer visitors than it should do. The other place I'd like to give a shout out for is even more off the beaten track, Arunachal Pradesh in the far northeast of India. It's a small Himalayan state that borders Tibet and Bhutan. It's known as the land of the dawnlit mountains. And it's really an unspoilt wilderness. Think snowy mountain passes, remote Buddhist monasteries, alpine forests, and literally hundreds of species of orchids. Very few people make it there. When I visited for the first time about 10 years ago, I was the only foreign traveller in the state that month. As you might expect, getting around is quite a challenge, to put it mildly, but it's an incredibly rewarding place. And it also showcases a completely different side to India, kind of away from, you know, the Golden Triangle that you mentioned earlier, Lucy. It's kind of, it's also a side of India that, you know, a lot of people in India aren't familiar with and, you know, don't always see. It's a magical place.
If our conversation with Shafiq has inspired your inner explorer, you can get closer to your next adventure with an array of new Decal Witness books. Try Outdoor Europe for discovering the great outdoors with over 150 activities, including coast steering, stargazing, foraging, forest bathing, and trail running. Or how about Ride, our guide to cycling the world, packed with over 100 adventures over 6 continents. Find both books at your local bookshop or click the link in our episode bio to browse our range.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Right. I'm just going to sort of start off by saying, Shafiq, why Antarctica? I mean, it's not your usual sort of place. I mean, we've talked about like kind of podcast first. This is the first time we've like zoned in on Antarctica. We did mention it in the last time you were with us. But yeah, why?
You know, I mean, I think quite simply, Antarctica is the greatest wilderness on Earth. You know, it's inhospitable, otherworldly, unfathomably beautiful. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of penguins huddling together, you know, looming icebergs the size of small countries, you know, pods of whales, great walls of ice, you know, that look like they've been sculpted by a surrealist. You know, I think traveling to Antarctica is perhaps the ultimate journey available on Earth, really. You know, and modern day cruises are now very comfortable. But, you know, as you're sailing through the region, it's kind of easy to imagine yourselves following in the footsteps of the great polar explorers, people like Amundsen, Scott, Shackleton. I think it's also a really interesting place because, you know, it gives us a stark, perhaps the starkest insight into the impact of the climate emergency. You know, obviously not that we should need to travel to the White Continent to be aware of that. But, you know, when I visited, I went to South Georgia, which is an island just north of Antarctica, with a photographer that worked with David Attenborough in the 80s and 90s. And he showed me how one particular glacier had retreated hundreds of metres since his first visit. Which was a powerful image, to say the least.
It sounds, Shaf, like it absolutely, Antarctica met your expectations. Because I imagine people going to Antarctica, it's not a weekend away, is it? It sounds like it just doesn't disappoint. It just sounds so epic.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I've been wanting to go to Antarctica. You know, it feels like all my life. And I went a few years ago on a 3-week expedition, setting off from Patagonia in Argentina and sailing via the Falkland Islands, via South Georgia, and then onto the Antarctic Peninsula. And it definitely didn't disappoint. I mean, no matter how many times you've watched videos or you've seen pictures or read books about it, nothing really, prepares you for visiting, and certainly nothing prepares you from actually setting foot on the continent itself. You know, it's kind of a mind expanding, humbling experience.
I mean, yeah, people use the term bucket list like far too much, but that really is like, you know, a kind of life goal experience. As you say, like kind of going and walking in the footsteps of those great explorers and going to somewhere where, you know, most people couldn't dream of being able to go to Antarctica. And there must be something really, really kind of special about that. But then, as you say, actually the beauty that's kind of attached to it as well, and that not disappointing too. What did you get up to when you've been in Antarctica? We did draft out some questions, and we have, you know, not to ruin the mystique of the podcast, but we do have like templates and stuff, and they're usually like best things to do, where to go, what to see, and it's like, oh, I don't think there'll be like, you know, a great taco truck in Antarctica anywhere.
Not yet.
Maybe there is. Not yet. That's a challenge, listener. That's it.
I mean, the cruises are actually incredibly, incredibly varied. With the company that I went with, they specialised in citizen science. So they really tried to get passengers involved in doing some scientific research. And this research fed back to, you know, institutions such as NASA, universities in the US and beyond. So we did cloud surveys. We tested water for microplastics. We did penguin surveys. That's a particularly fun experience.
I bet. And also, let's come back to that.
And also like whale surveys as well, obviously, because the Antarctic is incredibly rich in whales. So that kind of provided a framework around a lot of the other activities, which, you know, you could easily just spend hours and hours watching a giant iceberg drift by, or, you know, and until your fingers go numb, at least you can just wander around, you know, through a giant penguin colony, or get caught in a blizzard, or, you know, cruise around on a Zodiac boat. I also did something called a polar plunge, which they like to save for the end of the trips, which as you might expect is a quick dip in the in the water itself. We did it in a place called Deception Island, which is, if you imagine the caldera, the flooded caldera of a volcano that you can sail into. I think it's one of the only calderas that you can actually sail into. So the water there is supposedly slightly warmer than you would get elsewhere. It certainly didn't feel like that, and it was zero at best. So you have a bit of a swim, a plunge rather than a swim, really, and then you get out and try and desperately warm up as quickly as you can, which in my case took the best part of half a day.
I'm not surprised. How long were you in the water for?
You know, it felt like a lifetime, but it probably was only about 30 seconds.
Yeah, that cold then.
Well, did you actually like plunge in as well? Did you dive in, or did you gently? I mean, it's possibly worse to like gently go into it, right?
Yeah, so my top tip for this is, some people kind of delicately, gingerly walked in, kind of, you know, got themselves wet in stages. My approach was exactly the opposite. Took the clothes off, ran as quickly as I could towards the water, and then dived under. You have to get your head wet, really, for it to be considered a proper polar plunge. So I just did it as quickly as possible, and then I started swimming as quickly as vigorously as I possibly could to try and keep my heart from stopping and to keep me moving about.
Yeah, that's wise. I mean, that's a better approach.
Yeah, I think the opposite one of just letting yourself. No, I couldn't do that.
No.
I would step back. You don't want to give yourself any chance of backing out of that, I guess, do you?
No, absolutely not. You want instinct to take over, instinct and self preservation to take over.
Yeah. And then, Shaf, the penguin survey. I think listeners probably are like, tell us more about the penguins. What does that involve?
You know, it's quite a simple activity in theory. You know, you visit some of these huge penguin colonies. One of the colonies, I think, was 400,000 strong. So yeah, I mean, these are huge places. But you know, on the cruises, two cruises are the same. You're always following different routes. And because it's such a difficult and expensive place to carry out research, a lot of the places that you're visiting, you know, don't necessarily get a lot of scientific researchers. So it's very useful for the scientific community if you can do as much of, you know, much research as possible to help out a bit. And obviously doing penguin surveys is one of them. So, you know, it's you're kind of given a set area of land, and you try and count them, and you're also kind of noting down what types of penguins are there. And this, you know, because of the climate change, certain penguins that traditionally liked very cold conditions are, you know, having to move deeper south into Antarctica. You know, and other penguins are moving north. So it's, you know, all of this data is useful to get. The thing is, penguins are inherently comic and entertaining and curious creatures. So it often feels like, you know, you're supposed to keep, you know, understandable distance from them. You know, you don't want to interact with them. Passengers are generally good at following this. The penguins are not at all. And so they'll often wander up to you. You know, I've had them wandering through my legs before, and they kind of, you know, they have a quizzical look on their faces when they look at you, which can be quite disconcerting. So, it's not entirely clear who's studying who.
Do they ever attack or anything? Do they ever get aggressive? Or
they by all accounts, they can have a fearsome kind of peck on you.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I didn't experience this personally. And I think if you went a little bit later in the year when they have young around, when I went, there were just eggs. They can be a bit more aggressive, understandably. So one thing I did see in the Falklands, actually, so just, you know, further north from Antarctica, was something called a catastrophic molt, which I'd never come across before. But that's, you know, it's when the young are really changing their, you know, losing their feathers, essentially, and kind of, you know, it happens at, you know, particular times of the year. But they look like penguins from a horror film. I mean, it's kind of quite a scary, scary sight. But you know, these are just some of the kind of the unexpected things that you'll experience if you, you know, if you're lucky enough to visit Antarctica.
It's a really good band name, Catastrophic Molt. I have to use that one. But yeah, I can't believe, Shafiq, you can say that you've seen penguins molting and you swam in Antarctica. I mean,
Polar plunge.
Mm. I'm still shuddering a little bit at the thought of that. You know, I'm someone who finds it hard to swim in the sea in Cornwall. Never mind. Never mind Antarctica. So yeah, I really, really take my hat off to you. It's obviously tricky, but I know access to Antarctica has kind of slightly opened up. I mean, I think it's still quite difficult to go. But how regular are the kind of cruises, and how sustainable are they as well? I guess there's a big question around that, really.
Yeah, I mean, to take the sustainability question first, you know, an awful lot of people will say, from an environmental point of view, you shouldn't be visiting Antarctica at all. And, you know, in many respects, that's hard to argue with. It's kind of programs like the citizen science program in which I took part helped to, you know, hopefully help to kind of alleviate that to some extent. And also the company that I went with was very keen that passengers should leave as what they call polar ambassadors. Now, I know this sounds like quite a cheesy line that someone might say, but it's really that, you know, there's no resident population on Antarctica. It needs everyone else in the world to stand up for it. And I kind of think if you've been lucky enough to visit, you know, you need to be doing all that you can to, hold our political leaders, our business leaders and ourselves to account. Yeah. And to kind of to do what we can to protect it and do what we can to protect the world more generally and kind of, you know, face up and deal with the climate emergency. So that's That's the, you know, from a sustainability point of view. From a purely from a just a visiting point of view, I mean, during the pandemic, like traveling lots of places, Antarctica was, you know, the Antarctic cruises stopped. They are running again now. Roughly speaking, the cruising season runs from November to March. The overwhelming majority of the cruisers leave from southern tip of South America, most of them from the city of Ushuaia, which is one of the one of the most southern cities in the world in Argentina. And this is roughly the summer in the southern hemisphere. So it's a little bit warmer, and you know,
it's a balmy 0 degrees or something.
we've seen actually recently there've been kind of record high temperatures in the in Antarctica.
Yeah, of course.
And it's sometimes not always as cold as you might expect. Kind of even during more normal in inverted commas periods. But you should definitely prepare for the cold, because it's, you know, the cold in Antarctica really isn't like anything else that you've coped with.
Is it the coldest place you've felt on Earth? I'm guessing, or it must be, right?
It's the coldest place I've been on Earth, but I've been well dressed for it. The woolen boots and the multiple layers and all of that kind of stuff. You know, I have felt colder in various places, including in Bolivia, actually, overnight on the salt flats when essentially I was staying in a shack overnight and the temperature dropped to -21 degrees and kind of the inside of the very flimsy windows froze and... even wrapped in an emergency blanket, I've never felt as cold as that before. Nevertheless, Antarctica is still extremely bitterly cold.
Yes, but completely fine for a nice little plunge. All the same. Well, that was brilliant. I mean, it's amazing. Like, I mean, three amazing places, Shafiq. Couldn't be more different as well. In some ways, you've really given us some treats there in terms of things to take away from. I mean, three places which, you know, I think you've shown a different side to as well. I don't think many people would even consider going to Antarctica, but like, I love the fact that you've talked about different sides of India too. So thank you so much for that. As we've mentioned already, you can get Shafiq's book, Crossed Off the Map. It's available in all good retailers, I'm guessing, all bookshops.
In all good retailers and some bad ones as well.
yeah, all of them. It must, if not, complain. Thank you once again, Shafiq. Best of luck with the book. Can't wait to read it myself. And thanks once again for joining us on Where to Go. And hopefully, we'll have you back once again at some point soon.
Oh, I'm sure we will.
I can't wait. It was an absolute pleasure talking to you guys again. Thanks for having me on.
Lovely to see you, Shaf.
Thanks so much, Shafiq.
Thank you.
Huge thanks to Shafiq. Lucy.
Yeah, I think that's the word. It's just wow.
Are you going to take a polar plunge? I want to know that.
I will be honest, that bit didn't massively appeal to me. The penguin survey, I think, is more my vibe, James.
Yeah, I could see you doing a penguin survey.
Yeah, the polar plunge.
In like as many layers as possible.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, he said it was 30 seconds in the water and he took about half a day to warm up. And I think there's a Scandinavian phrase about there's not bad weather, there's just bad clothing, or there's not cold weather, and I'm not sure that this applies. I just think surely you just need to wear every item of clothing you can find,
everything you own.
I can't begin to imagine how cold that must be.
Yeah, that kind of like episode of Friends where he dresses up in like every bit of clothing that Chandler owns. Yeah, that's exactly what you need. So yeah, I don't think I could do a polar plunge either. So congrats to you, Shafiq, on that and your amazing book.
Yes.
So yeah, you can find, as we mentioned, you can find Crossed Off the Map in all good bookshops now. And if you'd like to find out what Shafiq is up to, you can follow him on Twitter at Shafiq Meghji. So that's S-H-A-F-I-K-M-E-G-H-J-I. And yeah, he's got a lot to say. You can find out all about his adventures and where he's going next.
Yes, and so in our next episode, we'll be going to Jamaica with food writer Riaz Phillips.
Yes, yeah. So getting back on our foodie train, we've had two episodes off the food, so I think it's about time we got hungry again. But Riaz is an expert on sort of Caribbean food, and will be kind of taking us around a culinary journey of the Caribbean. So very, very excited about that. But we shall see you then. That episode should be out in a fortnight. But yeah, it's bye from me.
And bye from me.
And thanks very much, listener. We shall see you very soon.
Where to Go was produced by the team at DK Witness and the wonderful Julia Baker. It was presented by James Atkinson and Lucy Richards and mastered by Johnny Coddington at Bottle Rocket Recording. For more information about DK Eyewitness, follow us on social media at DK Eyewitness or visit dk.com/eyewitness.
And don't forget to please like, rate, review and subscribe the show wherever you get your podcasts. Your support means so much to us.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.